Yemen's Ansarullah movement says that a visit by U.S. President Biden to the Middle East was only meant to empower Israel with Arab Muslims' money. Iran says that the U.S. president's allegations that the country is destabilizing West Asia is nothing but a failed rhetoric. And a Palestinian teenager is under arrest for allegedly running over an Israeli officer near the city of Ra'anana. Hello and welcome to World News from our Tehran headquarters. I'm Behruz Najafi. Beginning with Yemen, Ansarullah movement saying that the summit held in the Saudi port city of Jeddah, attended by visiting U.S. President Biden, was only aimed at serving the interests of Israel. Senior Ansarullah official Mohammed al-Houthi says that Biden's tour of the West Asia region was an attempt to prop up Israel with Arab and Muslim nations' money. Houthi also slammed the normalization of ties between some Arab regional governments and Israel. He said that the normalizations will never make Israel more powerful. Washington earlier indicated that Biden will use the summit to push for a military coalition of Arab nations and Israel against Iran. But no commitment to such an alliance was made by the participants. Joe Biden's visit to West Asia has seen a new rhetoric against Iran by Washington's ally, Tel Aviv. The two sides signed a declaration that pledges more military support for Israel and claims to counter what they call Iran's threats. Tehran has denounced the declaration and rhetoric by the U.S. president, threatening to use force against the country.
U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid have reiterated their anti-Iran positions in a joint declaration. The two leaders signed this statement after holding a one-on-one meeting on Thursday morning in occupied territories, on the second day of Biden's four-day tour of West Asia. The statement says that the U.S. will use all elements of national power available to it to deny Iran the ability to arm itself with nuclear weapons. The joint declaration also includes a pledge by Washington to continue U.S. military aid to Israel. Hours after the announcement of the declaration, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi warned of harsh and regrettable responses, saying any interventions of foreign powers in the region only results in crises and destabilization, while describing Iran's military power as a security factor. Observers believe that the unconditional support of the U.S. for Israel as the only regime that openly threatens Iran with military aggression can further embolden Tel Aviv.
I don't think that Biden's visit to the Middle East has really anything to do with the arms sale. I think that essentially he's come first and foremost to try to get the Saudis to push up oil production to try to bring down prices at the gas pumps in the United States as Biden moves toward November 5th. Midterm elections for Congress and the Senate, where right now he's expected not to do too well. What I think this stems from is Israel's push to try to get the United States thinking somehow that they're going to intimidate Iran, which is ludicrous. That's not going to happen.
While Iran topped the agenda of talks between the U.S. president and Israeli officials during the latest regional tour by Biden, the two discussed Iran's nuclear energy program and its military capability, which they label as a threat to the region. And that is while the U.S. has been pushing for the formation of a NATO-style military alliance against Iran in this part of the world.
U.S. President's visit to the region comes as Washington and Israel have been pushing for an alliance of regional countries against Iran, the so-called Arab NATO. At the heart of such military alliance lies the perceived threat from Iran. Iranian officials have repeatedly denounced the destabilizing activities of Israel as the main source of insecurity in the region, warning regional countries of the perils of allowing the regime to establish a foothold in the region. Regional states and nations will not achieve stability and peace as long as the fake Israeli regime remains the first stop of U.S. President's trips, with the main target being to preserve the regime's security and dominance. The Islamic Republic of Iran considers the security of its neighbors as its own security. Despite the growing relations between Israel and the Persian Gulf countries amid gradual American withdrawal from the region, several observers consider the emergence of a genuine NATO-style alliance unlikely.
You understand how much more powerful Iran has become in the region precisely because of its alliance with China and Russia. And so if you look at the offshoot of this, is that any threat to Iran also becomes a threat to Russia. Now, Israel, you know, people in Tel Aviv, they understand this. They understand that it's been a shift in the balance of power in the region, and this frightens them. The reaction has been the attempt to build some sort of Middle East NATO, and that's not going to fly. It's not going to fly any more than the talk of European unity. That doesn't exist vis-a-vis Russia. You know, it's just a contrived narrative.
A number of controversial questions are being posed by those analyzing Biden's visit and the so-called Arab NATO. The first question is whether the Arab states need such an alliance. Is the existing joint Arab defense framework so useless that it must be replaced by this new regional NATO? Second, the pact expects to be formed against Iran, but there are differing views on Iran's policies in the region. To include Israel, an occupier of Arab lands, in a new framework against Iran would only exacerbate the regional crises. In fact, a number of Arab officials have openly said in the past few days that their countries would not be a part of an alliance against Iran. And last but not least, not every country has normalized relations with Israel to form a common pact.
Iran says the United States is trying to foment tension and crisis in West Asia by resorting to the failed policy of Iranophobia. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani made a comment in reaction to the U.S. president, who has accused Iran of destabilizing activities in West Asia. He also slammed Biden for raising false allegations as regards Tehran's peaceful nuclear energy program, while ignoring decades of deception by the Tel Aviv regime as the largest possessor of nukes in the region. During an address to the GCC Plus 3 summit in Jeddah, Biden said that the U.S. will remain as an active player in the region and won't walk away to leave a vacuum to be filled by China, Russia, or Iran. The Qatari emir slams Israel as the major source of tension in the Middle East. Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani says instability will persist in the region unless the regime stops violations of international law. The Qatari emir noted that Israeli settlement constructions, attempts to change the demography of Al-Quds, and the blockade of the Gaza Strip are the root causes of instability and tension. He called for a just solution to the Palestine issues, stressing that the matter is a central cause for Arab and Muslim people. Sheikh Tamim made those comments during a GCC Plus 3 summit in Jeddah. Moving on, Israeli police say an officer has been killed after being run over by a Palestinian at a checkpoint in the occupied territories. It happened near the city of Ra'anana. Police have identified the Palestinian as a 17-year-old from the occupied West Bank area of Ramallah. They say that he's been arrested. No further details are currently available. Tensions have been running high in the occupied territories recently as the military has been cracking down on Palestinians. Some 60 people have been killed by Israeli forces this year, many of them in raids. At least 19 people have also been killed in Israel in attacks by Palestinian individuals since March. The International Committee of the Red Cross says that Yemeni women and children are dying on a daily basis, and that's due to poor health care services in the war-torn country. Our correspondent Abdel Latif El-Washali has a report from the capital, Sana'a.
Despite the UN brokered truce, the consequences of the Saudi led war are still taking the lives of Yemeni women and children. A recent report by the International Committee of the Red Cross says a mother and six newborns die every 2 hours in Yemen of complications that occur during pregnancy and causes that can be avoided in normal circumstances.
There is a severe shortage of medical supplies and medicines, as well as a significant increase in the prices of medicines, which has led to the deterioration of health services not only in the countryside, but even in main cities.
We as gynecologists have noticed a significant increase in the number of abortions, especially premature abortions in the early stages of pregnancy. Therefore, we hope to conduct studies that will reveal to us the reason and whether or not the prohibited weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition contributed to this tragedy.
The committee says the numbers are likely to increase due to a lack of health services or poor care provided, especially amid a shortage of funding for the United Nations programs in Yemen, as well as the termination of aid related to reproductive health and mother and child health.
The deteriorating economic situation has increased malnutrition among mothers, which has had a negative impact on newborns. The blockade of Yemen, which has kept medicines and medical supplies from entering the country, has resulted in an increase in death recently, and there are indications that the abortion rate has increased.
Recently, most of the United Nations programs, including the World Food Program, announced the suspension of their humanitarian activities in Yemen due to a lack of funding, as well as the consequences of the Russia-Ukraine war.
Yemeni health officials say 19 million Yemenis lack access to health care. They say it is a shame for the international community to abandon Yemeni women and the children who have been paying the highest price since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The COVID-19 Omicron variant BA5 is surging in South Korea, with new daily cases doubling to 40,000 per day this week. And this is another Omicron variant has been detected in that country, with growing concern about public apathy. Our correspondent Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Yet another wave of COVID-19 is hitting South Korea, with cases doubling to 40,000 per day in the past week. The BA5 Omicron subvariant accounts for almost a third of the new cases, a portion that is increasing. While experts recognize vaccines may not always prevent infection, they decrease illnesses and deaths.
Even people who have been infected with Omicron before are not able to develop enough immunity to this variant unless they are vaccinated. People who have been fully vaccinated and boosted but become infected have reduced chances of severe illness of 70 to 90%.
The fatality rate of COVID-19 has dropped to near the seasonal flu. Still, experts argue the changed behaviors of mask wearing and routine vaccinations should remain in place. The recent spike in COVID-19 cases here comes as South Korea Thursday detects the first case of BA2.75, nicknamed Centaurus. Scientists worry this highly mutated Omicron variant is even more transmissible than previous strains. Some want stronger antivirus enforcement, suggesting public apathy risks another COVID-induced economic downturn.
I know that more than 90% of corona can be prevented by wearing a mask, but if people keep coming inside and taking off their masks, I feel like it will be impossible to stop the spread. So the government should take stronger measures in that area.
People are required to wear masks on transit, but the government has said it will not implement lockdowns. People over 50 will be offered fourth vaccinations next week. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A sizable number of lawmakers blame the West's aggressive foreign policy toward Moscow for the cost of living crisis impacting EU citizens. The 27-nation bloc is facing an energy crisis after cutting off oil imports from Russia over the conflict in Ukraine. From Brussels, Jerome Hughes has the story.
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that 22% of people in the EU are struggling to make ends meet. That's almost 100 million citizens who are counting every cent. Apparently, sending weapons to Ukraine is not the answer.
The best way to deal with the cost of living crisis is to stop prolonging the war. The people of Europe favour peace, even well above punishing Russia.
EU financial markets are in turmoil. There are calls for the introduction of a windfall tax.
Energy prices and food prices are going through the roof. Capitalists make profits by speculating on markets and thereby hurting millions of households.
Members of the public have been talking to us about the current state of the EU's economy.
It's terrifying to see that our free market is like collapsing.
All the money that we are going to send to Ukraine, then we will have to need this money, and where we are going to take this money from.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has been singled out for criticism in the European Parliament.
We talk now about the increase of cost of living in the European Union, which is just a result of the insane and unsound policies promoted by the European Union since Ursula von der Leyen took office.
There have been calls for greater solidarity between EU member states to deal with the cost of living crisis.
In order to make sure that we are not at the end dividing Europe in those who are able to help and those who have more difficulties.
On sanctions against Russia, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has said, quote, "Initially I thought that we had only shot ourselves in the foot, but now it is clear that the EU economy has shot itself in the lungs and is gasping for air." Many here agree. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
And that brings to the end of this broadcast from Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. The next recommendation is that you must make the most of the people's faith for producing good deeds. The people are pious and have faith. This faith can produce good actions. You can do this. Our magnanimous Imam was a master at this. Imam was a genius in making the most of the people's faith for producing good deeds. The next recommendation is that you should not let some people pretend that the country has reached a dead end. This is some people's job right now in cyberspace. Now some individuals do it out of negligence or they are paid to do it. I do not know, but they want to pretend that the country has reached a dead end. No, the country will not reach a dead end. This happened at the time of Imam too. At that time, some people wrote in newspapers that the country had reached a dead end. Imam said, no, it is you who reached the dead end. The Islamic Republic will not reach a dead end. He said that it was they who had reached a dead end. This is the truth of the matter. You should not let them disappoint the people.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The next recommendation is that Imam would sometimes criticize executive officials in private or in public, but he would also sometimes express his appreciation for their efforts. There are many cases in which Imam explicitly thanked the officials of the country, either one official or a group of them. My recommendation is that now that the enemy is after damaging the reputation of revolutionary officials, the duty to appreciate the value of officials is a heavy one. We must express our appreciation of officials. When we see that in the Abadan incident, a minister goes there for 3-4 days and inspects the matter from close up, is very important. That the honorable president or vice president goes and meets with casualties and comforts them and consoles their hearts is very valuable. They must be thanked. Of course, the agents behind the damage inflicted must be punished, both in Abadan incident and every other incident. Those who inflict damage must surely be punished. Dear God, by the blessed souls of our dear martyrs and the immaculate soul of our Imam, make us among the followers of the legitimate and true path of the Islamic Republic. Dear God, I ask you to make our steps and those of our nation steady on this path. I was informed that today, during the speech of Haji Hassan Khomeini, some people made noise. I'm opposed to this. I'm not at all right with such acts of damaging someone's reputation, with such commotion. I'm opposed to it. Let everyone know this. I hope the God Exalted guides all of us toward the right path, God willing. Greetings be upon you and God's mercy and blessings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
U.S. President Joe Biden touched down in West Asia. Meanwhile, it has emerged that his administration is considering lifting the ban on the sale of offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia. However, reports say the final decision over the issue is expected to hinge on whether Riyadh makes progress towards ending the war in neighboring Yemen.
This decision, supposedly hinging on whether or not Saudi Arabia makes sufficient political progress towards a negotiated solution with Yemen, as articulated is in fact absurd. It's completely backwards. Rather than forcing the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to the negotiating table, what it does instead is, of course, fortifies the lethality of the Saudi military, and it also, as well, gives it increased leverage at the bargaining table.
According to media reports, senior Saudi officials pressed their U.S. counterparts to scrap a policy of selling only defensive arms to the Persian Gulf Kingdom in several meetings in Riyadh and Washington in recent months. In February 2021, Biden said he was ending support for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, a policy that included a ban on the sales of offensive weapons. But it was later revealed that U.S. contractors were still maintaining Saudi warplanes that were bombing Yemen. And the Biden administration approved the sale of air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia in November 2021.
Therefore, if the United States actually seeks to end the genocidal war against the people of Yemen, this decision to continue offensive arms sales such as precision-guided munitions to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is the exact opposite of what it should in fact be doing.
That's why one of Biden's main objectives will be to get Riyadh to increase cooperation with Israel. Although full normalization is not expected, Saudi Arabia could take a step in that direction by allowing Israeli flights in its airspace or by quietly increasing military cooperation to counter Iran. While in Israel, talk of military support for the regime was a priority for Biden. At home, any move to rescind restrictions on offensive weapons is sure to draw opposition in Congress, including from Biden's fellow Democrats and opposition Republicans who have been vocal critics of Saudi Arabia. However, the U.S. president is stuck between a rock and a hard place. If it does not yield to providing Saudi Arabia with more weapons, the kingdom may not have an appetite to reset relations with the U.S. at this point in time. Let's not forget, as a presidential candidate, Biden denounced Saudi Arabia as a pariah. Yet, Biden's approach has softened since the start of the Ukraine war, which has prompted the United States and other Western countries to appeal to Saudi Arabia to pump more oil to offset the loss of Russian supplies.
Well, you know, due to U.S.-sponsored sanctions on some of the world's largest oil producers, Iran, Venezuela, and Russia, President Biden is facing a crisis that is largely of his own making and that of the United States. Therefore, he comes to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia essentially as a supplicant with his hand outstretched to plead for increased oil production. President Biden, unfortunately, does not have any vision or plan for the Middle East.
The Saudi regime is considered one of the most despotic regimes in the West Asia region, which routinely violates the rights of dissidents. It has engaged in a brutal war against Yemen, which has killed thousands of people, including countless women and children.
U.S. President Joe Biden visited Israel to once again express Washington's unconditional support for the Israeli regime. This is his first trip to the region since taking office. Biden's visit to Israel follows the collapse of a coalition-led regime headed by Naftali Bennett. Biden opened his visit by offering anxious Israeli leaders strong reassurances of his determination to stop Iran's nuclear energy program, saying he'd be willing to use force as a last resort. He said it would not remove Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps from the U.S. list of so-called terrorist organizations, even if that meant wrecking the Iranian nuclear deal for good. Biden and Israel's Prime Minister Lapid have signed a so-called security declaration affirming their united front against Iran.
So I would not qualify this joint declaration as anything but some kind of posturing. Joe Biden, as any U.S. president before him since 1967, has basically been beholden to Zionist interest, and he cannot hold any kind of discourse which deviate from this notion that Israeli national interest and U.S. national interests are one and the same.
Biden made reviving the Iran nuclear deal, brokered by Barack Obama in 2015 and abandoned by Donald Trump in 2018, a key priority as he entered office. Biden said Trump made a gigantic mistake by withdrawing the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal. But talks for the U.S. to re-enter the deal have stalled as Biden has stuck to his predecessor's tactics, piling up on the sanctions and refraining from giving guarantees that Washington would not abandon the deal again.
Despite all measures of good faith and all efforts and all kind of flexibility from the Islamic Republic of Iran, the United States under Joe Biden has not only maintained the maximum pressure doctrine sanction regime installed by Trump, but has failed to lift the sanctions that were the object of negotiation back in 2015, and should I say, has gone out of its way to show really bad intent in the context of the negotiation.
Joe Biden has vowed to boost Washington's military support for Tel Aviv. Iran says U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to the Middle East will not bring security for the occupying regime. President Ebrahim Raisi said if the visits by American officials to the region are intended to reinforce the Zionist regime's position and provide impetus to the normalization process, the efforts are bound to fail. Tehran has also slammed the U.S. for keeping up unconditional support for Israel. Biden is also following up on Washington's agenda of enabling normalization between Arab states and Israel, which is aimed at pushing the Palestinian cause to the sidelines. Upon disembarking from U.S. Air Force One, which arrived at Ben-Gurion Airport, Biden said he did not think a Palestinian state was likely to happen in the near future. Just as Biden was visiting Israel, the regime's military bulldozers began plowing lands belonging to four Palestinian villages between Ramallah and Nablus. Israeli settlements in the West Bank, which house more than 600,000 settlers, are viewed by Palestinians as a major obstacle to their future state and lasting peace between Jews and Palestinians. Israeli rights group B'Tselem says the U.S. government should be held accountable for the Israeli regime's violations. Leader of Lebanon's resistance movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah, said a lot of hope and illusions are built around this visit. But the United States of today is not the same as it was in 2003 and 2006. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas stated that Biden's remark upon arrival in Tel Aviv emphasizes support for the Israeli regime.
The Israeli, on the other hand, are desperate to enroll Arab states, and Saudi Arabia is the master prize, which is why we've seen all this courtship going on. Mostly on at the behest of Tel Aviv, trying to lure the crown prince to sign some kind of alliance. And in this respect, this joint declaration, as Joe Biden sets out to visit the officially the GCC, but let's not make any mistake about it, to meet Mohammed bin Salman on the sideline of this forum, is aimed at trying to tell him that his interest, his security interest, lies with Tel Aviv. This remains to be seen.
It's now widely believed that Biden's much-hyped visit to Israel and Saudi Arabia is doomed to fail and will not bring any substantial change to the realities of the region.
The devastating impact of the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout continue to take a toll on the world and provide ample reason to reconsider where taxpayers' money is being spent. Several countries have even come to the conclusion that their budget is better off being spent where it can potentially ameliorate the economic pressure on their citizens. In the U.S., however, while such reassessments are long overdue along with the trillions of dollars Congress and successive administrations have lavished on the Pentagon, lawmakers have decided to once again shower the Pentagon with cash, even more than what it asked for. Interestingly enough, this comes while the massive US arsenal and fighting force deployed worldwide have proven to be powerless against grave, non-military threats to national security. Gas prices in the US are at an all-time high. Rent prices have set records for the last 13 months straight. Inflation is increasing so sharply that even the cost of basic utilities has risen by nearly 30% in the last 12 months. There are growing fears that the economy is poised to fall into recession. And now, at a time when Americans are fighting to keep roofs over their heads and feed their families, Congress's plan is to authorize a record-setting $838.8 billion in spending to the Pentagon, nearly $40 billion more than what the military asked for.
American taxpayers should be angry. They are angry. Many are not only angry, they are incensed, and they are protesting. But unfortunately, too many elected representatives in this country aren't listening to their constituents. They're listening to the representatives and the lobbyists of the military-industrial complex, such as Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, and General Electric. So when you have those companies and so many others that are pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars into the political campaigns of members of Congress and members of the Senate and the president, when they are pouring millions of dollars into their political campaigns, when they spend just an inordinate amount of time on Capitol Hill lobbying for their interests, then you're going to wind up with policies and programs that are sending money to the Pentagon instead of sending money into states for schools and retirement programs and the other types of social welfare programs and that are needed in this country.
The U.S. Congress is on track to give the Pentagon $37 billion more than what the military asked for. And this comes while Congress could use this money to pay for a variety of things Americans desperately need right now, like school lunches, affordable housing, and utility assistance programs. Even just lowering taxes by that amount or giving this money directly to the American people could put more than $100 in the pocket of every single American at a time when they desperately need it. Not only would spending in such ways benefit the individuals and communities that receive them, it would also help revitalize the U.S. economy and make it more equitable to boot. As has been well documented, defense spending is one of the least economically productive ways the government can spend its money. Spending on education, healthcare, and lowering taxes, for example, have all been shown to create more and higher-paying jobs. So why is Congress poised to give government contractors the biggest taxpayer-funded payday they've ever received, despite the heavy economic implications that the move has on the country?
Well, the reason that the United States government is pursuing war strategies is because America is still an imperial hegemon. And so you have people like Tony Blinken and Avril Haines, Samantha Power, Jake Sullivan, Victoria Nuland that are influencing decision makers and policy to try to start fights with Russia, try to start conflicts with China, start to continue to try to start conflicts with Iran to justify this immense military spending.
Pentagon contractors invest heavily in efforts to get more taxpayer money. They've spread their influence and money around the lobbyists, PR firms, and think tanks to ensure that the money is funneled in their way. In short, this is the military-industrial complex, and it is working overtime to raise the Pentagon budget at taxpayers' expense. And while much of Washington is on the racket and will also profit from this wasteful government spending, it's Americans struggling to keep the lights on who will pay the price. President Biden has almost unlimited ways of communicating with the world, but he opted to pen an article posted online Saturday night by the Washington Post to defend his pending West Asia trip in light of the controversies around it. In the piece, he speaks about many issues, including further integrating Israel into the region, Washington's ties with Riyadh, the Saudi-led war in Yemen, the Iran nuclear deal, and more. While most of the matters mentioned in the article are centered around West Asia, they also seem to share another point. The U.S. itself is either complicit in or directly responsible for the very issues it claims that it is trying to solve.
The U.S. Lies through its teeth without stopping a minute. We've seen the debates and discussions about the comprehensive agreement with Iran, which they had promised to renegotiate, and they seem not to be negotiating in good faith. They're trying to paint themselves as innocent, which of course they are not. And they just had a recent rebuff at the G20 meeting in Indonesia, where Mr. Blinken refused to sit down with the leaders of all these states.
Saudi Arabia, infamous for its violations of human rights and under widespread criticism for its bloody war on Yemen, as well as the killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, is a focal point of Biden's West Asia tour. But despite this, the U.S. president's framing of the Saudi relationship appeared particularly defensive. During his election campaign, Biden had pledged of making Saudi Arabia a pariah for its crime. But now he has ironically claimed that ties with Riyadh helped promote the U.S.'s foreign policy ambitions. Similar to the other issues, the U.S. president also tried to take fault away from his administration in regard to the Iran nuclear program file by putting the blame on Iran. Biden also stated his readiness to further pressure Tehran despite Tehran's readiness to return to the deal, and this too sheds light on the U.S.'s ironical foreign policy. One of the main purposes of Joe Biden's visit is the salt deepening of Israel's integration in the region and moving forwards with the Abraham Accords, which is the pillar of normalization deals with Israel. But the latter has raised questions regarding Biden's foreign policies, as Israel itself seems to be the source of the problem in the region, from its atrocities against Palestinians to its continuous attacks on Syria and its repeated threats against Iran. In the op-ed piece, President Biden says the U.S. helped end the 2021 war on Gaza, but fails to condemn Israel for its atrocities and violation of Palestinian rights. Biden also proudly mentions the U.S.'s $4 billion support of Israel. But what does all this demonstrate about the U.S.'s stance on Palestinians who have been subject to Israeli brutality for years now?
Well, the issue of the United States and Israel is a burning issue right now, and the U.S. has acted in a hypocritical way where Russia has attacked special military operation in Ukraine to denazify it, and we know what Nazis are. So, and yet, so the U.S. has spent $40 or $60 billion arming these countries, letting all those Ukrainian youth be killed who were forced into fighting Russia. And yet, with respect to Gaza, 8 months earlier, Israel unleashed a horrible attack on Gaza, and the U.S. hummed and hawed, tried to sort of say, maybe we'll calm things down. They didn't spend $40 billion to arm the resistance against Israel. And that is a term which I call tongue-in-cheek. I don't know whether you know the term. It's sort of a sarcastic term because obviously the U.S. is not going to do that. But it's related to empire.
The U.S.'s one-sided stance on Israel is also clearly demonstrated in the Shirin Abu Akleh case, where it stopped short of reaching a definitive conclusion in her killing by Israeli troops, while all other investigations reached the conclusion that the regime troops did in fact murder her. Now, despite Israeli crimes, Washington seeks not only to integrate the regime further into the region, but also aims to advance its plans to upgrade defense cooperation between Israel and Arabs in the light of the Abraham Accords. And all this raises the question of whether the U.S. truly seeks justice and advocates for human rights, or it only claims to do so in order to move forward with its agenda.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Welcome to Arab English Radio. This is Asma, your humble host for today's episode, and you're hearing me from Q&A on Islamic Belief, where you could get the answers to all your questions. Well, today we have Dr. Karimi, scholar of religious studies, who will help us with the answers. Assalamu alaikum and welcome, Dr. Karimi.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. The question says that, is it possible for a man who is not Muslim, but he has been a good man or woman, whatever, a good human being, they have practiced humanity at its whole and they helped human beings in so many aspects, would they go to heaven?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So as Muslims, we believe that in our time, I mean, from the time the Holy Prophet was sent as the last prophet, the true path is the religion of Islam. And as Shia, when it comes to different Islamic denominations, we believe that the Shia school of thought is the true path. But does it mean that all Muslims, or to make it even more limited, all the Shias, or only the Muslims and only the Shias will go to paradise and the other ones would mm-hmm. go to the hell? That is the question that many people ask. I mean, non-Muslims ask the Muslims, non-Shia ask the Shia. So first of all, there is no guarantee for all the Shia and for all the Muslims to go to paradise.
I see.
We have the concept of faith and then righteous deeds. So it's highly dependent on your actions.
So even
actions.
Not all the Muslims would go to heaven.
Yeah, that's the point. It is completely dependent on your iman, faith, and amal salih, righteous
your deeds.
Yeah, good deeds. That's the first point. But what about other people? So this is for sure. When it comes to the matter of issue of truth, for sure we believe that Islam is the true path. And when it comes to different Islamic denominations, We believe as Shia that Shiism, the 12 Shiism, is the true path regarding the truth. But what about the salvation? That's another story. Does it mean that only the Shia will reach salvation and other people will go to the hell? Then the answer might be different, and inshallah I will explain in today's session. So first of all, we may talk about the people who lived before the Prophet, and for sure they were not able to hear the message of Islam. What about them? Like the Christians before the time of the Prophet, our Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, or the Jewish people at their time. The point is that whether they acted upon the religion of their time or not. So for sure, there have been so many Christians before the Prophet who acted upon the religion, and they will go to paradise.
So everyone is going to be judged based on their own book.
Exactly.
And their religion.
Before the time of the Prophet, yeah. Yes. And even the Jewish people at the time of Jesus, it might be different, because the Jewish people at the time of Jesus, they needed to follow Jesus as the new prophet. They, couldn't continue to follow the Sharia of Moses, mm-hmm. because the new prophet was Jesus. Now, it is related to my discussion about the Jewish people and Christians in our time. So the first point is that we might have Jewish people, we might have Christian people who lived at the time of their prophet, acted upon their religion. So for sure, they will also go to the heaven. But what about our time? In our time, we said that the truth is the religion of Islam and Shia school of thought. What about other people? We have some people who do not follow the religion of Islam and the Shia school of thought, and they have studied about them, and they have come to this conclusion that Islam is the true path, Shiism is the true path, but they are not ready to follow that. We can think of such people in our time and era. They know that this is the true path, but for any reason, they are not ready to follow this path.
So consciously, they reject it.
Exactly. So these are, and there are not many of them, maybe, in our time. And I'm not judging about that, but it seems that there are not many people like that in our time and era. So for sure, these are the people that would be punished on the Day of Judgment as disbelievers who didn't have any excuse for not following the true path.
They knew the truth. Because they have seen it and they have been through it, but they rejected it.
Exactly.
When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created paradise and hell, Jannah and Jahannam, the first thing that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala did was to send Jibreel alayhi salam. And he sent Jibreel alayhi salam to Jannah. And he said, go and see what I have prepared for my slave who worships me and is obedient to me. Jibreel alayhi salam, he went and he saw the splendors of Jannah. He saw those things which no eye has seen, no ear has heard, and no mind can comprehend. And similarly, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala then instructed Jibreel alayhi salam to go and see Jahannam. And Jibreel alayhi salam, he went and he saw the ferocity of the fire of Jahannam. He saw one part of the flame engulfing another part, enveloping the other part of the flame. He saw the horrors of Jahannam. And he came back, he said, oh Allah, by your glory, there will be no one who will enter Jahannam. It's so scary and gruesome.
What is more populated, heaven or hell? There are Muslims who believe that the vast majority of people go to heaven. It's that Shia school of thought. Where it goes, the logic behind it goes like this. God is just. God says, follow the law. Humanity is divided into three groups. One group that knows the truth and follows it. Of course, those will go to heaven, right? One group that knows the truth and rejects it. But the vast majority of humans fall in the middle. The vast majority of people on the face of the earth would follow the truth if they were given an equal chance to know where the truth is. But it is that most people, due to environmental and other influences, are not given an equal chance to know the truth. So the vast majority of people go to heaven.
Now, what about the people that they do not know anything about the religion of Islam or Shia school of thought, and I mean, they have not heard about that.
Is it possible in our age for someone not to
That's
have
a very
heard
big question
it?
That many people doubt. I will come to the concept of Mustadafin, which is mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran. Let me give the dear listeners a principle. The principle is that if you have done your best to find the truth and then you are not able to find the truth, you are excused before God. This is a principle. So as Muslims and Shia, we believe that when it comes to the concept of truth, Islam is the true path, Shia school of thought is the true path. What about other people? If they have done their best to find the truth, but they were not able to find the truth. For example, a person comes to the conclusion that Christianity is the true path, or Judaism is the true path.
Knowing that Islam exists?
Yeah. Knowing that Islam exists, knowing that Shiism exists, they tried their best to find the truth, but for any reason, they are not able to find the truth. After going to different, to searching about different schools, religions, their final conclusion is that Christianity is the true path. And then, according to the verses of the Quran and the narrations, for sure these people will not be punished by God on the Day of Judgment.
Because their capacity was that
exactly.
Much.
This is a principle that لا يكلف الله نفسا إلا وسعها. Allah does not task any person beyond his or her capacity.
Exactly.
But the point is that whether or not they have done their best, this is a very big question. And we are not judging about the people, whether, they have
Everyone
done.
Knows what they have done.
Yeah, exactly. So everything, this salvation on the Day of Judgment is absolutely dependent on you whether trying your best to find the truth or not. This is one point. And then the next point is that, you have, theoretically speaking, you have done your best, and then you came to this conclusion that Christianity is the true path. Have you acted upon this religion or not? So the concept of good actions matter in all the religions, because many of the sins, most of the sins are common between different religions. All the religions tell you that be away from backbiting, murdering, killing, telling lies, adultery, and so on and so forth. So for all the people following different religions, they will be accounted by God for their actions. So we have the concept of faith, and then we have the concept of, the deeds. For the faith, as I mentioned, what matters is that whether you have done your best to find the truth or not. Then we have the issue of the deeds, and it doesn't make any difference whether you're Muslim or non-Muslim. For all the people, they should be, and they are responsible before God on the Day of Judgment. So when we refer to the verses of chapter Nisa and then the narrations, we come to this conclusion that there are some people who are called in the terminology of the Quran and the narrations as mustadhaf or murjaun al-amrillah. I will explain these two terms in the following session, meaning that there are some people who are not able to find the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And God mentions explicitly in the Noble Book of Quran that these people will not go to hell. Yeah, we have this concept taken from or explicitly mentioned in the Quran. Let me read three verses of chapter An-Nisa, which are very interesting, explicitly talking about these people. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said in chapter 4, verse 97, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. إِنَّ الَّذِينَ تَوَفَّاهُ الْمَلَائِكَةُ ظَالِمِ أَنفُسِهِمْ Indeed, those whom the angels take away, talking about the time of their death, while they are wronging themselves, قَالُوا فِيمَ كُنْتُمْ They ask, what estate were you in? The angels asking those people. قَالُوا كُنَّا مُسْتَدْعَفِينَ فِي الْأَرْضِ They say we were... Now, the translation here is oppressed. It's not a good translation. What you mentioned was much better, deprived of getting the knowledge of the truth.
They did not have access to.
Exactly. We were deprived, we were mustadhaf in the land. Now, those angels say, قَالُوا أَلَمْ تَكُنْ أَرْضُ اللَّهِ وَسَحَدًا فَتُهَاجِرُوا فِيهَا The angels are mentioning what you mentioned in the previous session, the fact that in our time, no one may have the excuse that I do not have
access. Because internet has made everything pretty much easier.
This is mentioned by the
You're
angels.
You're an armchair traveler.
Yeah.
Everything
the angels do
hand.
Not talk about Googling, but they mention as follows. أَلَمْ تَكُنْ أَرْضُ اللَّهِ وَاسَعَةً فَتُهَاجِرُ فِيهَا The angel says, was not Allah's earth vast enough so that you might migrate in it? Meaning that, in, for example, in that time, internet was not available. But you could migrate to other places to find the truth. فَأُولَٰئِكَ مَأْوَاهُمْ جَهَنَّمْ وَسَاءَتْ مَصِيرًا The refuge of such will be hell, and it is an evil destination.
Such a bad destination.
So here we have a group of people who claim to be mustad'af, to be deprived, but the answer of God through the angels is that no, it's just